Rejecting ISIS, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Tanya's husband, John, wanted to raise their three small kids as jihadis. Then this happened.
One day, for some reason, one of my sons came home with a grenade to show me. Oh, I lost my temper and pulled out my kitchen knife at John. I was like, don't ever do this again.
Now she's renounced extremism and lives in Texas. Also, why migrants crossing the Mediterranean fear going back to Libya.
We hear a lot about people risking their lives at sea to cross to Italy, but really the worst ordeal for these people are the detention camps in Libya.
Plus, one opinion about white people wearing dreadlocks.
A white person with dreadlocks is feeding in to a bigger system of oppression.
That and much more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. I hope if you had a holiday, it was a good one, and if you didn't, that some TLC is coming your way real soon. We've got a lot to catch up on today after the long weekend, and we're going to start along the world's deadliest border, the Mediterranean Sea. You may not think of it as a border, but each day, flimsy wooden and rubber boats set out from Libya, packed with migrants who are counting on luck to get them across the water to Europe, as well as some passengers too young to even know what's going on.
There were many, many babies, many pregnant women, and many tiny babies. There was a three-day-old baby who'd been born in a detention center.
That's correspondent Megan Williams. She spent the last 2 weeks on the migrant rescue boat Aquarius in the Mediterranean, reporting for the CBC program The Current. And you've just docked in Sicily at the port of Catania. You were patrolling in international waters about 25 miles north of Libya with the NGOs SOS Mediterranean and Doctors Without Borders. And you captured the moment when the Aquarius docked safely in Sicily. Let's just hear that. Megan, tell us what's going on here.
When I hear that, it does really just want to make me cry. And that's the way I felt every time I heard the singing on the boat. And there was a lot of singing. I mean, these are people who have been through so much. Yet, you know, the fact that they gathered around again and again to just sing out their thanks and their joy after having been tortured and deprived of food and put their lives and their children's lives at risk. It's so moving.
I mean, that singing really suggests what a relief it must have been to have this journey behind them. You were at sea for almost 2 weeks, Megan. Initially, the team you were with carried out three successful rescues, but then something different happened later in the week, right? Tell us about that.
The worst moment really was Friday, because again in the morning we got the call from Rome saying there are several boats in the area. And so the Aquarius rushed towards one of them. And as we were about a mile from this overcrowded rubber dinghy, we could see the people straddling the side of the boat, so there was no space to move. We got instructions from Rome. Even though we were in international waters, they wanted the Libyan Coast Guard and naval ship in the area to carry out those rescues. And it was heartbreaking, because what the Libyans do, of course, is they take those people back to Libya. And we hear a lot about people risking their lives at sea to cross to Italy. But really, the worst ordeal for these people are the detention camps in Libya. I mean, I talked to many men and women over the days on the boat who we rescued, and all of them talked about being tortured. The women were raped, I think pretty much everybody. Some women didn't want to talk about it, of course, but the violence in Libya is terrible. So to see that boat, and, you know, I was standing on the bridge with binoculars, to see people have to get off that rubber boat and get into a Libyan naval ship and go back to Libya after they'd paid thousands of dollars.
It's also heartbreaking. This incredible video from the CNN reporting that came out last week appearing to show African migrants sold as slaves in Libya. It's captured a lot of attention. Is it something that the refugees and others on the rescue boat were aware of, and were they talking about it?
Yeah, I mean, they all talk about being sold. There's sort of two different types of being sold in Libya. One is the traffickers will have a group of, say, 200, 400 people, and usually they're from one specific geographical area, either Eritrea or, say, you know, Gambia. And they swap these groups. They'll sell a group. So after extorting this group of people, forcing them to slave labor, abusing them, they get them to phone home and have their family wire money to the traffickers. So after that happens, they'll sell the group to another group of traffickers, and they have to go through the same ordeal. So one group of Eritreans had paid $3,000 each, and then their group was sold. And so they had to pay another $3,000 to another smuggler. And many of the men get taken out and forced into slave labor. And then there's also the type of slavery that was featured on the CNN video, where there's actually auctions going on, which the men talked about too, where they're sold off, you know, for $400 to work for someone for a year or however long.
Megan, just introduce us to one or two of the people who were rescued. What kind of physical shape were they in, and what are they looking forward to next?
There's some really terrible stories, and I don't even think I want to tell the most terrible, but one tiny, tiny woman who did the trip on her own with her three-year-old son, who's the tiniest child I've ever seen. I mean, absolutely emaciated, but he was full of energy and lively, so I think he'll be okay. But he traveled with his mother, and she spoke a little English, and she told me that crossing through Sudan into Libya, that they have these what they call stores, which are just, I guess, little warehouses crammed full of people. And at each stop along the way, the women are raped by the Sudanese soldiers. And she said this, another woman said it too, that the women, the Eritrean women, all take the pill before they leave on the journey because they know they're going to be raped.
Correspondent Megan Williams, based in Rome. She spent about 2 weeks on the migrant rescue boat Aquarius in the Mediterranean for the CBC program, The Current. Thanks very much for your reporting, Megan.
Thanks, Marco. Pleasure to share this stuff, as awful as it is.
If you ask David Miliband, the concerns of those migrants and the situation they find themselves in, fleeing their homes, counting on luck to bring them a better future, those ought to be concerns for all of us. Miliband heads the International Rescue Committee. He's also just published a new book called Rescue, Refugees and the Political Crisis of Our Time.
It's true that there are plenty of people who are fearful of refugees arriving in the US, to take that as an example. But for every one of those, I know there are people who want to stand up and say, hang on, my parents were refugees, or my neighbor is a refugee, or I work with refugees at work, or this is a core part of the American or European story, that we stand up for people who are fleeing war or persecution and will offer haven for those who need safety.
David Miliband, in terms of your own family history, your parents were both refugees who came to the UK after the Nazis rose to power. And the untold story in your family was about the fate of your grandfather. Your mother was 5 years old the last time she saw her dad. And then out of the blue, you received an email a few months ago, and you took a trip as a result of that email. Tell us about that.
It's been the untold story of our family, of how my grandfather perished. He was also called David. I was named after him. And in March or April this year, I got an email from a German historical group who wanted to confirm who I was and explain that they'd found the last documentation that tracked the movement or the transportation of my grandfather from Auschwitz in November 1944, 14th of November 1944, to a small concentration camp outside Stuttgart in southwestern Germany. He perished there on the 19th of January 1945 and was buried in a mass grave. And it's thanks to the efforts of the local German Historical Society that the truth has finally been told nearly 80 years later. And my mother, myself, my aunt, and my brother, we all went to this incredibly emotional site of family trauma. But we also saw the way Germany has come to terms with its own history. And I think there are lessons here for all countries, because the determination to find the truth and tell the truth is what has motivated this German historical group of volunteers. And all countries have their own history that they need to come to terms with. The US, I mean, I now live and work in the US. You are having your own debate as far back as the Civil War. And the failure to tell the truth, the failure to address the sins of history allows things to fester. And I think one example that we can take from Germany is that the determination to educate future German generations about what happened in the Second World War has been a source of strength for them, not a source of weakness.
This was just a few weeks ago that you were standing around your grandfather's new gravesite. What went through your mind at that moment when you're there with your family?
Well, the obvious thing that goes through your mind is that there but for the grace of God go I. How lucky one is to have been able to live, really, because strangers helped my mother. Strangers, a Catholic family in the middle of Warsaw, saved my mother's life. And it was their ability to see humanity and to reach out and save it that allowed our family tree to continue. That sense of human empathy and human solidarity is precious and needs to be kept burning for generations to come.
How do you square the efforts of those Germans who sent you that email, who are trying to come to terms with their country's past, with the rise of the radical right in Germany, and what all this means for the future of people who have fled their homes in Syria or Iraq or Eritrea and are now in Germany or other parts of Europe?
The stakes could not be higher for Western societies. Obviously, many of those fleeing today are a different religion from my family. There's different global politics today. But the issues are essentially the same, which is whether or not we owe any duty to those in desperate need who are fleeing on grounds of persecution or war. Western leadership after the Second World War meant that refugee rights were established for the first time. If we trash the rights of refugees, we don't just trash our own history. We also take risks with the stability of the world going forward. Because obviously, in an interconnected world, if we turn our backs on desperate people, then others will fill the vacuum.
David Miliband's new book is called Rescue, Refugees and the Political Crisis of Our Time. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Authorities on the Indonesian island of Bali say Mount Agung, the big volcano there, could erupt at any moment. And if you've seen the video footage released by Indonesian authorities, you know it looks pretty scary already. Huge clouds of ash billowing out from the top of the volcano and streams of thick gray mud flowing down its sides. Officials call that cold lava. My BBC colleague Rebecca Henschke is in Bali.
Images and video I've seen, it looks almost like this river of wet cement coming down, and some of the rivers are swelling and flooding rice paddies, and some rice farmers having to be helped out because they've been caught due to the speed of this rising water.
100,000 people live around the volcano. The Indonesian government is urging them to evacuate, but tens of thousands of people are not leaving. These villagers from Ahmed on the east coast of Bali explained why. One man says the villagers are worried about leaving their livestock behind. He said they're willing to go to evacuation centers in the afternoon, but in the morning they have to stay and feed the animals. Another villager says she's scared but can't leave because she doesn't have any money. If she had it, she adds, she would leave. So now officials are preparing to evacuate people by force. Some people, though, who want to leave can't. That mostly means tourists. Bali counts on a lot of tourism for the island's economy. This man from New Zealand was stranded when the international airport was closed.
Last night, our airline put us up in a very nice hotel, but we've now been told that it's not their responsibility until Wednesday. So we're on our back. We're running out of money, and we've been told it's not our problem. It's a natural disaster. Find your own way until Wednesday night, unfortunately, and obviously still no guarantees that we'll actually get home on Wednesday night.
The last time Mount Agung erupted was in 1963. More than 1,500 people were killed. The Indonesian government says it's much better prepared this time. Coming up later in the show, comedian Hari Kondabolu has a problem with one of the characters on the long-running cartoon show The Simpsons. It's Apu, the South Asian who runs a Quickie Mart. So just how mad is Kondabolu?
I'm a 35-year-old man. I'm not furious about the cartoon, but these kinds of images and ideas sneak in and they become more sophisticated. What was brownface in one era is then a cartoon with an accent in another era. And in this era, it is still probably a gross simplification of the immigrant character.
More of my conversation with Hari Kondabolu, that's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Pope Francis arrived today in Yangon, the largest city in Myanmar, and the question on everyone's minds is, will he or won't he? Will Francis use the word Rohingya to address the plight of Rohingya Muslims? They're the minority group in Myanmar that the U.S. and the U.N. both say are the victims of ethnic cleansing. More than 600,000 Rohingya refugees have fled Myanmar following a brutal crackdown against them by the country's military. Those refugees are now in neighboring Bangladesh. The World's Jasmine Garz is on assignment in Bangladesh as we speak. We reached her on the streets of the Bangladeshi capital, Dhaka. So why does it matter if the Pope says Rohingya or not, Jasmine?
It's the power of a word, Marco. It's controversial because Myanmar does not use that word. They don't consider the Rohingya to be a minority group. They refer to them as Bengalis, and they call them illegal immigrants to Myanmar. They say they should be living in Bangladesh. The Pope has referred to the Rohingya in the past in previous speeches, but he's been advised by the church's sole Catholic cardinal in Myanmar not to say it. And the reason is, basically the message to the Pope from within has been, don't stir things up. There are 500,000 or so Catholics living in the country. And there's just concern that this could stir up a lot of ill will.
It does seem like an especially politically charged time for Pope Francis to visit this region. But is that the point of this visit?
No, actually, the Pope had this trip planned for quite a long time, and then this situation unfolded.
Now, following the time he spends in Myanmar, the Pope is headed to where you are currently, the Bangladeshi capital, Dhaka. What's the schedule there?
Yeah, the Pope arrives here on Thursday, and he's going to be meeting with members of this country, Bangladesh's Catholic community. He's scheduled to meet with Rohingya refugees as well. You know, to be honest, there's very muted enthusiasm here to the Pope's visit. In total, Christians account for less than 1% of all people in Bangladesh. This is a majority Muslim country. And it's also the Pope's first visit to Bangladesh.
So I imagine humanitarians are going to wonder if Pope Francis, his man of the people, will have any effect on the crisis in Myanmar. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think more than anything, it will be a diplomatic test for him on how he handles something that what he's allowed to say in each place and how it can impact some of the Christians living in Myanmar if he does use the word Rohingya.
So last week, Myanmar and Bangladesh announced an agreement on returning Rohingya Muslims. What's been the reaction to this deal where you are in Dhaka?
The reaction has absolutely been one of concern and one of empathy. People are quite worried about what they see as their Muslim brothers and what the conditions are for their return. Aid agencies have expressed concern that it's just not safe to return these people. Bangladeshis see Rohingya as their Muslim brothers and sisters. And they generally, you speak to the everyday man here and they will tell you, it's probably not safe to send them back to Myanmar. And, it's been quite heartwarming to hear that response. Bangladesh is a very small country, and it's quite strained right now for resources. But people are very concerned about what happens if the Rohingya are returned to Myanmar. And they see it as their duty to protect them.
The World's Jasmine Garz in Dhaka, Bangladesh. Jasmine, thanks very much for this.
Thank you.
Jasmine is in Bangladesh with our Across Women's Lives team reporting on where many of the clothes we wear here in the U.S. are made. Next week on The World, we'll be bringing you her stories from Bangladesh. It's a long way from Syria to Texas, but the actual distance traveled is the least of Tanya Georgelas's story. She and her husband, John, traveled to Syria in 2013 with their three small children in tow. He would become an ISIS fighter. She and the kids escaped. My BBC colleague Rikin Majithia caught up with her in the Lone Star State.
It's an unusually windy day in Plano, northern Texas. A mother chases her little boys around a leaf-strewn playground. They're happy and carefree. It's a scene of family innocence that belies a deeply troubled past. Between 2011 and 2013, Tanya and John Georgelas traveled around the Middle East, indoctrinating their children to become jihadists. Tanya's journey into extremism had begun more than a decade earlier, as a London schoolgirl.
I just wanted to change my identity. I wanted to be Salman Pai, someone that people didn't call a tart. And Islam just sort of helped me feel like I belonged somewhere, like a family or a community that embraced me as long as I complied to what they were comfortable with.
She started wearing a face veil and came under the influence of radical groups. In 2003, she met John Georgelas on a Muslim matrimonial website. He was an American convert living in Damascus. Within weeks, they were married.
He was clearly intelligent, he was charming, and we were best friends.
The couple had children in the United States. While there, John was imprisoned for an attempted hack on the website of a pro-Israel lobby group. When he was released, the family moved to Egypt, which was then governed by the Muslim Brotherhood.
One day, for some reason, one of my sons came home with a grenade to show me. Oh, I lost my temper and pulled out my kitchen knife at John. I was like, don't you ever do this again. I don't want my sons near these things. I don't want them near the guns. I don't trust you guys.
By now, Tanya says she was already having reservations about a life of jihad. When John took them to Syria in 2013, she was 5 months pregnant with their fourth child.
The buildings I stayed in, they were abandoned homes. The windows had been blown out and there were bullet holes. I didn't know what to do.
After 3 weeks in the country, she pleaded with her husband to let her and her children go. He agreed. John stayed in Syria and went on to join the so-called Islamic State. Until earlier this year, the group controlled vast swathes of territory in Syria and Iraq, where it implemented brutal rule and killed thousands of people. Tanya now lives in the United States. She says she hasn't heard from John in over a year.
The last message was that he apologizes for the wrong that he's done to me and the children, that he prays that we'll be Muslims, and that if I don't hear from him in 6 months, it's most likely because he's dead, because the fight is drawing closer to where he lives.
The children are looked after by John's parents and appear well adjusted to American life. Tanya has divorced their father and has plans to remarry. She says she's turned her back on extremism and no longer practices Islam.
It was a relief to come back, and it gave me the opportunity to read other things. Like, I had the freedom to think. That's what America gave me, without fear.
Why should America give you a second chance, given all that you did to propagate extremism against this country?
I realized I was wrong, and I really want to make up for my mistakes by contributing to society. I want to help get rid of this problem.
If you were to meet a woman who was thinking about going down the same path that you once took, what would you say to her?
I'd say, I lost my family, I lost my home, I lost 10 years of my life that I should have been working at towards my education and a career. I have 4 children who don't have a dad now. Is this a situation you want to be in?
Tanya Georgelas in Plano, Texas, speaking there with the BBC's Rikin Majithia. I'm Marco Werman. Comedian Hari Kondabolu's always been a fan of The Simpsons, but he hates the character Apu.
You're allowed to be critical of something you love. I mean, I think whether that thing is The Simpsons or America, that's part of what love is.
The problem with Apu, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Egypt is still reeling from what has been called the deadliest terror attack in recent memory there. On Friday, a group of suspected ISIS-affiliated militants bombed a mosque in Egypt's Sinai Peninsula, then opened fire on worshippers as they tried to escape. More than 300 people were killed. News accounts highlighted that the target was a Sufi mosque, and a lot of media outlets have described Sufism as a more mystical version of Islam. Some reports have added that the mysticism includes music and dancing and reverence for saints. All of this is broadly true, but as writer Shadi Hamid points out in a new article in The Atlantic, it is a bit more complicated than that. So today on The World, we want to better understand what Sufism is. And for that, we got in touch with Hamid, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Shadi, your article in The Atlantic is actually titled Misunderstanding the Victims of the Sinai Massacre. So break it down for us. What is Sufism?
Yeah, so Sufism isn't something that is apart from Islam. Sufism has been intertwined with Islamic history and tradition for the better part of 14 centuries. It's only more recently that we've come to see Sufis or Sufism as some kind of gentle, peaceful other, that they're the good, tolerant, pluralistic ones. And of course, many Sufis are are those things. But I think the danger there is when we say that, we're presuming that non-Sufis aren't tolerant or pluralistic. And some Sufis might be more permissive when it comes to ritual or Islamic law, but many Sufis are actually quite orthodox. And I think it's that side of it that we don't always pay that much attention to. And by orthodox, I mean they wouldn't necessarily be that enthusiastic about dancing or music or be pro-gender equality, you know, the kinds of things that we associate with Western liberalism. And many of the Sufis that I've met over time are actually quite strict and orthodox.
So how are Sufis seen by non-Sufi Muslims? Can you generalize about that? Is there a distinct difference between how kind of stereotypes in the West about Sufis and how non-Sufi Muslims see Sufis? Is there a big difference?
So I think that one way of looking at Sufism is, first of all, just to say that it represents a dimension of Islam. So you can be any kind of Muslim but still integrate Sufi practices in your observance. And that can include things like a weekly hadra circle where some chants are uttered, or things like the veneration of saints. But generally what it's really getting at is the elevation of the personal connection with God and the inward aspects of Islam. And that's theoretically open to all Muslims, and that's why throughout history it wasn't a big deal to be part of a Sufi order. That was quite normal and mainstream. But technically, Sufis, if we want to just be very definitional about it, Sufis are those who are members of Sufi orders. There are, of course, other people who are not members of Sufi orders but integrate various Sufi practices, but they may not self-define as Sufi. So again, I think that problematizes this idea that, oh, all the people who are at a certain mosque are Sufi or see themselves as Sufi. You know, as these things often are, it's a bit more complicated. There are other more sort of conservative strains of Islamic interpretation that do see Sufis as a problem, especially Salafis, the sort of the ultra-conservative of Muslims.
So your concern is that this coverage may be creating a narrative of a quote-unquote better kind of Muslim.
Yeah, because if we say that Sufis are the tolerant and pluralistic Muslims, it means that the non-Sufis are presumably something else, right? And I think it also feeds into this, I think, Western obsession where we're always, as Americans or Europeans or whatever, trying to find moderate Muslims and to then elevate those moderate Muslims as the example for other Muslims. And we're going to the Muslim world and we're saying, hey, these are the good ones. Why can't you be more like them? And that's not just about Sufis or Sufism. I think that's a subtext of so many of our conversations about Islam and Muslims and politics. And I think especially now, considering the rise of Islamophobia, I think we should probably be even more sensitive to that.
Shadi Hamid is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and co-editor of the new book, Rethinking Political Islam. Thanks very much, Shadi.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
It's gotten quieter since the summer, but the question of whether to take down signs and symbols of the Confederacy has not gone away. And it's not just the U.S. that's struggling with a divisive history. France has its own colonial past to deal with. And recently, the Paris City Council weighed in on one particular image. The council voted to remove a controversial sign that's been up on a Paris wall for more than a century. But some of the neighbors say the sign should stay where it is, even if it does seem racist. From Paris, Adeline Sia has our story.
Place de la Contrescarpe in the Latin Quarter of Paris is a picturesque cobblestone square with a fountain surrounded by cafes and terraces. But there's an antique sign here that has reignited a controversy. It's a 19th century painting on a building above a grocery store. It shows a black man and a white woman in 18th century style servants' clothes about to share a beverage in a sitting room. Above the painting is the infamous name of the original shop. In large letters, it reads, Au Negre Joyeux, or At the Happy Negroes. It's been a flashpoint for years.
L'enseigne au Nègre Joyeux est régulièrement l'objet de vandalisme.
Michel Sidom says the sign has been vandalized, and he understands why. But he's part of a group of Parisians who disagree with the city council's decision to remove it and put it in the museum. The sign may be a remnant of France's colonial past, he says, but it's a relatively tame one.
On voit bien qu'il y a un homme de couleur de peau noire, une femme de couleur de peau blanche.
You can see there's a black man and a white woman both standing. The woman has a chambermaid outfit, she has an apron and a bonnet. The man has a napkin around his neck, so they're most likely shop employees or servants. So it's not the worst colonialist picture you've ever seen. Amélie Fabot-Mamet, who's in Sidom's group, agrees the picture itself is not offensive. But she says even if it were, it should stay on the wall because it's part of France's history. Fabot-Mamet has lived in this Paris neighborhood for 20 years, but was born and raised in Cameroon, a former French colony. Her group wants the city to put up a plaque next to the painting that explains the disastrous consequences of colonization.
C'est la vérité, une trace de l'histoire.
It's the truth. It's a trace of history, a basis for discussion, she says. It invites people to look up and talk about it. We have to confront our history and look at it with courage. But City Council Representative Raphaël Primet, who voted to remove the sign, says a plaque would not be enough.
On pense que si elle a été plusieurs fois
The fact that the painting has been vandalized several times is proof that many people still find it offensive, she says. An explanation on a plaque would not neutralize its negative message. Louis Georgetin, who's head of the Representative Council of Black Associations, or CRAN, says even if the painting's scene can be interpreted in different ways, there's no doubt about its true purpose.
This image serves colonialist propaganda. The name Happy Negro is meant to give an enchanted image of what was a crime against humanity. It distorts reality.
To him, though, this is only one of the many objectionable signs still on display in Paris, like a 19th-century ceramic tile sign that depicts a half-naked slave serving a well-dressed white man in a tropical setting. Even worse, in Tain's opinion, is the statue of Jean-Baptiste Colbert, who was Louis XIV Minister of Finance in the 17th century.
In front of the National Assembly building, we have a statue of Colbert, this minister who legalized slavery. At the top of the Assembly building, it reads liberty, equality, fraternity, even though Colbert was the enemy of all three. So in France, we have a problem recognizing what our core values and symbols are.
Tain goes on to say he wishes French mayors would follow the lead of some American officials who have moved to take down Civil War monuments, especially after Charlottesville. Back on the Latin Quarter Square, a woman passing by stops to look at the Happy Negro painting. Radia Benefissa says she's not sure what to make of it, but in her gut,
j'aime pas.
I don't like it, she says. Benefissa says she's confused by the image. It seems racist to her. Is it about slavery, she wonders. Or does the fact that there's a black man and a white woman eating together mean whites and blacks are equal? Hard to say. The Paris City Council had planned to take the painting down last week and have it restored before sending it to a museum. But residents who oppose that will now get a hearing that could potentially keep this controversial image up on the wall. For The World, Adeline Cyr, Paris.
You can see that controversial sign in the French Quarter of Paris over at PRI.org. Let's shift now to another debate, a debate over a TV character you probably know, Apu from The Simpsons. He's been a presence and not a happy one in the lives of many South Asians living in America. Count stand-up comedian Hari Kondabolu, an especially vocal critic. The World's Rupa Shenoy and I recently spoke with Kondabolu about his new documentary, which is called The Problem with Apu.
My name is Hari Kondabolu. I've had a great career filled with laughter, critical acclaim. I should be completely happy, but there's still one man who haunts me. Apu Nahasapima Petalon.
So if you've seen The Simpsons, you know Apu is an immigrant from India who's a convenience store clerk. Can you explain why Apu is such a big deal?
Apu was the only character that South Asian Americans had on mainstream American television for a good chunk of my youth. So the only real representation was a cartoon character voiced by a white guy who was a stereotype.
How did that play out for you as a kid?
You know, initially, I loved Apu just because we didn't have anything. So when you're hungry, you will eat anything, right? So that's kind of what it was. It was like, finally, we're being acknowledged, right? And Apu is really not a representation of South Asian Americans. It's a representation of the South Asian immigrant and the Indian immigrant specifically. It's more about my parents than it is about me.
So, Hari, at one point in the doc, you kind of step back and you say, you know, there are people who will call this project PC and say you're too sensitive about it. How do you respond to that?
I don't think people like their institutions questioned, especially beloved institutions. And I understand that. I'm a Simpsons fan. But, you know, you're allowed to be critical of something you love. I mean, I think whether that thing is The Simpsons or America, that's part of what love is. And I think that criticism comes from the idea that we can be better. You know, my mom criticizes me all the time. I don't question the fact she loves me.
Do you think this is, you know, the best way we can talk about things like this in the Trump era where so many people are sensitive? I mean, we have to think about how we approach the conversation, right? And it seems like you're making it easier for folks.
There's an accessibility in The Simpsons. It's something that is beloved. It is something that is relatable. So to question something as basic as a cartoon and The Simpsons, I mean, I feel like it's a softer way in.
Hari, I was struck in the doc by your interview with Utkarsh Ambodkar, who was brought on the show to voice Apu's nephew. You know, if you're driven by a certain anger by what Apu represents, I sensed a kind of an optimism on Utkarsh's part, you know, a younger generation just ready to defeat these persisting racist blind spots. Am I wrong?
No, I think that's right. I mean, the anger to some degree is part of a narrative device.
You're saying it's part of the act?
To some degree. I mean, like, I'm a 35-year-old man. I'm not furious about a cartoon, but these kinds of images and ideas sneak in and they become more sophisticated. What was brownface in one era is then a cartoon with an accent in another era. And in this era, it is still probably a gross simplification of the immigrant character. I don't know that many major characters who are immigrants who have a great deal of complexity. I don't know how many immigrant stories that are from the perspective of the immigrant.
A lot of the documentary is you kind of pursuing Hank Azaria.
We're trying to get Hank Azaria to be in the film. He's the voice of Apu.
It's been months, and Hank Azaria appears to be ignoring my requests to talk about Apu on camera.
Is there anything symbolic? I don't know. I felt like it would be validation of the journey or something like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I think talking to him for me was an opportunity to have a real conversation. You know, it's been 30 years. What's done is done, you know, like, I hope they don't kill the character because I feel like that's really lazy. I would actually rather them come up with a interesting solution. Like, I don't know, maybe he owns Quickie Marts. Maybe he's a small business owner instead of just being in this subservient position. Maybe his kids actually have a voice and represent my generation versus just being a joke. See, there's 8 of them. India has 1 billion people. Yeah, we get it. It's been the same joke for 30 years. At the bare minimum, I hope we have these larger discussions of what happens when a large group of people is seen in these really marginalized, singular ways. And I don't think Hank saying, yeah, I shouldn't have done it, is a solution. But at least asking him, where was he then and where is he now with this, would have been really interesting.
So you open the conversation. This doc is not going to be a funeral for Apu, nor was it your intention. But do you think Apu's always going to kind of be shadowing you? Was that your first laugh? Because this is a pretty serious interview.
Yeah, it's an intense conversation for a cartoon character. I think that character is going to shadow me as long as there's institutional memory of that character. But I think the idea of the caricature, the ridiculous Indian American, I think that's going to be around for a little bit longer. I think the Big Bang Theory has one of those characters, so it's not like it just goes away. So for me, I think, yeah, it will for a little bit, but I do think that whenever there's an Aziz, whenever there's a Mindy, whenever there's a Hasan Minhaj, like there's an example of, oh, it doesn't need to be this way.
Hari Kondabolu, thanks so much for your time.
Oh, thank you, Mark. I appreciate it. Thank you, Ruba.
The World's Rupa Shenoy, host of our Otherhood podcast, with the last word there. Hari Kondabolu's documentary, The Problem with Apu, premiered on True TV earlier this month. The phrase cultural appropriation comes up a lot here in the U.S. in response to certain questions like, is it right for white people to wear dreadlocks? Or was Pharrell Williams on solid ground when he put on a Native American headdress for a photo shoot? We're asking, a lot of people everywhere are asking. Our friend at the BBC, Mobeen Azhar, has a new radio series in which he looks into how cultural appropriation has been spreading in the UK. It's called Offence, Power and Progress. Mobeen, to start us off, what do you understand by the whole idea of cultural appropriation?
Well, I came to this with a very generic understanding of cultural appropriation and the idea that increasingly it seems that people are offended. But as I kind of dug and tried to unpick what these terms mean, I think cultural appropriation refers specifically to the idea that a dominant culture takes from a less dominant culture without due respect or without due compensation. So an example of that could be where you have, say, white Western culture taking from Asian culture without due accreditation, without compensation, that might be financial, and without accrediting that culture.
One of the people you spoke with for the series is Shadeen Taylor-Stone. She's part of a UK black feminist punk band, and they actually ban white people with dreadlocks from their gigs. How did she explain that?
So Shadeen actually and the band together came up with a kind of manifesto. And as part of that, they said they would not tolerate symbols of cultural appropriation, including the wearing of dreadlocks and the wearing of bindis. You know, bindis, the forehead marking,
right,
which is rooted in Hinduism. Now, Shadeen told me anecdotally about being at concerts and actually going up on the mic and pointing out at white people with dreadlocks and saying to them, look, you really need to be aware of where these symbols of other people's culture are coming from. Now, Shadeen's argument, which I'm sure will rile some of your listeners up, Shadeen's argument is that white people having dreadlocks is indicative of systematic and systemic racism. So she will say it's actually to do with institutional racism. It's to do with bigger problems. It's to do with it being more difficult statistically for black people to get jobs and so forth. Now, when you really push Shadeen and you say, well, look, isn't it to do with intention? Surely if a white person just has dreadlocks because they like the look of it and it's something that they just want to do, they're not stopping anyone from getting a job. Isn't it just to do with intention? Shadeen says very clearly that intention doesn't matter. So I asked her in every way I could, I said, is there a non-racist way for a white person to have dreadlocks? And Shadeen thought about this, and her response was, she doesn't think there is. So a white person with dreadlocks is feeding into a bigger problem of racism in her view.
There is an argument that you may know that the logic of cultural appropriation is based on a false idea of purity, that labeling any part of culture as exclusively one thing or another ignores the fact that all cultures borrow, mix, and steal, if you want, from each other. Has that become part of the debate in Britain?
Absolutely. But again, it's hugely polarized. Mm. So again and again, there are people who have written comment pieces. I would speak to individuals whilst I was making the documentary who would say the entire argument around cultural appropriation is rooted upon a false premise, because the food we eat, the clothes we wear, our cultures are an amalgamation of lots of different things. There's also an argument that if you push the cultural appropriation debate to its natural conclusion, it will mean that no one can do anything because we'll all be offending each other and we'll all end up walking around on eggshells. But I think the fact of the matter is that in a contemporary context, the people who are pushing this debate are predominantly young and they are idealists. Now, historically speaking, young idealists always debate these ideas, always debate ideas that mainstream society will see as being niche, we'll see as being a bit out there, we'll see as not being part of mainstream discourse. And what happens is these ideas slowly filter up and they become part of the mainstream narrative.
Your family is from Pakistan, Mobeen. Have you ever found yourself offended by some cultural thing that was taken on by a Brit that you thought, nah, that's just weird or simply wrong? Like when you see a Brit put on the classic tunic, the salwar kameez, what do you see?
Marco, I'm not an easy guy to offend. I'm quite difficult to offend. It's really interesting you should say this, because I got married in August. One of the ceremonies, thank you very much. One of the ceremonies was rooted in Pakistani culture. And so many of my friends who are not of South Asian descent got in touch and said, is it going to be offensive if I wear particular clothes? So I had to send out a kind of blanket email and a blanket text saying, I am not offended by non-South Asians wearing South Asian dress. And it was wonderful. Everyone ended up wearing South Asian clothes. It was really colorful. It was everything that I wanted it to be. So I personally have not been offended.
That's so 2017, though, an addendum to the wedding invite on cultural appropriation terms.
It is so 2017, absolutely.
Mobeen Azhar, friend of the show with our partners at the BBC. Thanks as always, Mobeen.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Let's get back to that idea that all cultures borrow from each other. I recently discovered the latest recording by Malian guitarist Boubacar Traoré. It's called Dunya Tabolo. And like a lot of music performed by Malian guitarists, Traoré presents you with a chicken and egg question. What came first, the blues or this music from West Africa? It's just that with this Boubacar Traoré album, you're likely to scratch your head even more, partly because of this guy on fiddle, Cedric Watson, whom Boubacar Traoré sought out for this recording. Cedric Watson is based in New Orleans and brings a Cajun sensibility to West African music, which he has studied closely. His fiddle covers parts that might be played by the West African Njarka, a one-string violin made out of a gourd. But to hear those parts played with this American back porch orientation feels like a key that's unlocked a secret. The new Boubacar Traoré recording offers numerous such moments where the blues and these Malian sounds draw closer together. It's not scholarly proof of the kinship these two styles have, but it is still magical. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. See you back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.